Yo, Tad Pals, we're back. That's a dive. Season 3, episode 11. I just realized, PJ, on the formats that you read out for me, that you've been listening to episodes. I never realized that before. I mean, episode 11, it sounds like, I mean, that sounds like we've done a lot of work.
Yeah, I think we're probably 50 at this point total.
50?
I'm not sure, yeah.
What do I get when we hit 100? Do I get anything?
I don't know. I mean, we just got new computers.
Like a gold mic or something?
The budget could be getting out of hand if we get to
100. New computer. Where are the new computers?
Yeah, you can't even tell because you never... We don't let you touch the computers.
Yeah, you don't let me go near the computers. Yeah, we got flat screens in the studio. I mean, it's season 3, episode 11, new computers. I've got a coffee. I just burned the roof of my mouth. So I'm not going to be able to taste anything for the rest of the day, but we got another Tadpod. And we got a review from Fishtown FC. As a United supporter, I love hearing Kyle confirm I'm not crazy. You may be. I've always shared your opinion on Jose. That's what I'm talking about. A United fan that's with me. There's one. Thank you for being a rational voice. So I choose Old Trafford as my stadium to visit, but I'll bring Kyle so we can put boots on the ground and get some anti-Jose chants going. I mean, am I anti-Jose?
I think that was the whole thing. Well, yeah. Last week you were kind of going back and forth, but
well, last week I finally admitted to bias against Manchester United based on Jose, which I stand strongly it might be confirmation biased in that I thought very early on and I went out on a limb when other people were not being as strong and said, this is a bad move. Don't hire this guy. That was before he got the job. That's when Sir Bobby Charlton was saying, don't hire this guy. And they said, Sir Bobby, look over here. We got you a stand. And then hired him when Sir Bobby was looking at a stand. But yeah, I would say I'm an anti-Jose guy. I mean, I'm not anti-Jose in that I don't respect him. I mean, the guy is one of the greatest coaches of all time. I'm not a Jose fan because I don't like watching the way typically his teams play to win. I mean, I think that Real Madrid team, the Porto team, and then, you know, here and there is Chelsea teams. Every now and then, and recently is Manchester United team, and we'll get to that in a second. But every now and then, his teams, you know, play a very attractive, attacking minded game. They're irreverent. They're free flowing. They're entertaining. But that's an anomaly. Typically, his teams are not really all that thrilling to watch, especially when it's a big game. Mm-hmm. And just his behavior, you know, how he treats people, how he belittles everyone, how he just won't take responsibility for anything. I mean, because of that, I'm anti-Jose. So,
I think it's always been anti-Jose with Manchester United because the current state that they've been in and him coming in hasn't been a good fit.
Totally. When he went back to Chelsea, I thought that was a great move and it worked out. And I said that. I said, you know, getting Jose again, he's the best manager they've ever had. He came back immediately. They won. And listen, did he leave things a mess? Yeah, but they recovered quickly. Because they churned through managers nonstop, it wasn't going to be a big deal that they were going to have to fire Jose after a few seasons. So it was a great move. For Manchester United, no. And that's what many people were saying, is that for certain clubs, Barcelona, never. And that's one of the reasons Jose has a massive chip on his shoulder, is that he was looked over for Pep when Pep hadn't done anything. I mean, you know, coaching, you know, B teams and youth teams, you know, that's impressive, and I'm not belittling that. I mean, I haven't done any coaching, so, you know, what do I know? I'd be a terrible coach. But Jose didn't like that he was deemed not good enough for Barcelona, and he will never be up for that job.
Yeah.
And Manchester United just seemed like, you know, the other place where I thought, no way, they don't do it. But they've done it, and that's going to be one of the topics. We're going to talk just kind of recent Jose Mourinho stuff, Manchester United stuff, but we're going to talk about that Everton game. We're going to talk about Spurs, Manchester City. We're doing more game stuff this time. Yeah. I mean, we typically don't do that. This is like the two Robbies show.
It's a big game, though.
Welcome to the two Robbies.
You trying to be the third Robbie?
I'm Robbie Earl and Robbie Basso. but first, something serious and something that, it was just, it was hard to believe. And I was off this weekend. And when the news came through that there was an explosion outside the King Power Stadium, and that was the first thing I heard. And I got really worried about immediately, you know, terrorist stuff. And when I heard there was an explosion right outside, I immediately thought, oh, no. You know, I mean, that's the thing that we're always worried about, where stadiums, you know, people getting together to go and enjoy themselves all in one place, and you would just hate for something awful like that to happen. But something awful did happen, and the Leicester City owner, Vishay Srivastava, he lost his life in a helicopter accident. He and four others,
five total.
As the helicopter was leaving the stadium, and it's something he does often, where the helicopter will land after the game, and you can see it in some of the post game studio hits and interviews. You see his helicopter sitting there at the center circle, and so many times before it took off, and he headed home, headed off to what he was going to do, and this time it barely got out of the stadium before something went wrong, and obviously there are investigations, and there were early reports that weren't confirmed, but now we do know he was on that plane, and there was a mechanical error that had the helicopter go down, and no one survived. And it was, you don't have to be a fan of Leicester, you don't have to know someone to just be heartbroken, and it was heartbreaking. You know, covering the Premier League, we get to know these people, and that's the, I guess that's the fun part of sports, and sometimes the tough part of sports is you feel like you know people, and they can let you down, they can make you happy, you know, that you can relate to them, you could be frustrated with them, all these things where you feel like you're interacting with these people. And, you know, I think he's a very rare example of an owner beloved universally. I mean, I would say outside of a decision that ultimately was the right decision, that was one of the hardest decisions he ever had to make as an owner, to fire Claudio Ranieri after one of the, if not the most incredible sporting accomplishment in the history of sports, 5,000-1 to win the Premier League, deciding to fire him. Initially, people were very critical of that, and he took, you know, a lot of criticism I don't think he deserved, but I think quickly people realized that, man, it took a special, brave, smart, connected owner to make such a massive decision. And so because of all these things, because we cover this game so intimately, and, you know, back to the Nigel Pearson drama, and
which also was a big call.
It was a huge call. You know, and his son being involved with him, and you know, taking over and transforming a great club, but a yo-yo club, a club that kept popping into the Premier League, popping back down, first division back down, you know, almost went into liquidation and bankruptcy, and fans step up and save them. So this, for me, is an owner that he was special. He was a special sports owner. And in a time where the modern game is just becoming unromantic, you know, enormous wages, agents running their mouths, players not being loyal, you know, saying they don't want to play, I don't want to train, I'm not going to show up. And all this stuff is, you know, the rising ticket prices, all of these things have slowly sucked some of the romanticism and some of the beauty out of this incredible game. But it's owners like Vishay that remind you how special the game still is. And you see in the response from fans and from players how important he was to the club. And there's that cliched saying, you know, no one's bigger than the club. I mean, this guy was the club. And he did it with such a quiet charm. He never wanted to be in the spotlight. It was never about him. You know, they were constantly available to the players. Some of the, you know, if you didn't see it, Kasper Schmeichel wrote an incredible thing, and it's on and Christian Fuchs and
Jamie Vardy.
You could see these were players pouring their hearts out. This wasn't just a sound bite or a little, you know, thoughts and prayers. I mean, these players were compelled to write on paper, you know, on a tweet or any social media platform they could find, just pour their hearts out and be vulnerable and say how important this man was. So it's just a really sad day in the global game to lose such a special person. You know, to lose anyone is tough, but to lose someone who's affected so many lives in such a positive way, I mean, just reaching every corner of this world. Yeah. I mean, that Cinderella story made people believe. It, you know, it made people fall in love some with the game for the first time. I mean, yeah. it transcended everything, and he was central to that. And so for that, he's always going to be remembered for one of the greatest sporting accomplishments of all time. And there's just no easy way to, you know, to say that you know, thoughts and good vibes and support to his family and to his loved ones, his wife and his son, later Arif at the memorial, where, I mean, it was just a sea of flowers and cards, and it was it's going to take a while to get over that. Yeah. And I give you know, Arlo White so much credit as someone who loves that club and grew up in that part of the world and has supported that team so closely. I mean, it's so hard for him to be neutral, and he does a great job at it, having to cover that season. I mean, imagine that. You're you know, you're like a Cubs fan, and after all you've been through, you have to call the down the stretch, the World yeah. Series. I mean, Arlo did an amazing job doing that, and an amazing job delivering just the report, which is tough to do when you know it was an emotional thing for him and for all of us. And so, you know, just everyone involved with this, from his family and extending to the fans and extending to all of us, you know, just hug someone, you know,
yeah.
hug someone close to you, because it reminds you that the game is just a game. It's just, yeah. you know, we make it seem like it's, you know, the most important thing in life, but it isn't. And the game, had to stop for everyone to just remember a beautiful man.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to add, you know, Arlo tweeted out his opening report from yesterday, like that you said was very well put.
Yeah,
and
that's so hard,
you
know, to do.
Try to put everything into context as much as you can in a difficult situation like this. And so it's on Twitter if you need to find it at Arlo's Twitter account.
So. Ugh, yeah. So just an awful tragedy. And you know, to segue it into another fan situation that's beautiful in a celebratory sense. You know, I saw the Leicester fans getting behind their players, the family, and just showing you how powerful fan support is and how important it is to be a part of a family like that. And I was fortunate to feel that with one of my old clubs this past weekend. I went back to Columbus for the first time in over a decade. I mean, it's been a while. And the genesis of that was similar to that Leicester story of the fans getting together to save the club. A large group of Columbus supporters started Save the Crew because it had become known that the ownership, Anthony Precourt, who bought the club with a clause in his contract that he could move it to Austin after a certain amount of time, making sure that he obviously put the effort in to make Columbus a successful franchise. And I'm not here to point blame or disparage anyone or say he did a great job or didn't or always wanted to leave. I mean, all of that is irrelevant at this point. The great part of going back to Columbus was it was a celebration about that wonderful club, the club that gave me my dream of playing professional soccer. That club is not going anywhere, and it's because of the fans. And it all started with a tweet. I sent a tweet out when I was just frustrated. And I got asked the question a lot during the presidential election. Obviously, that news had just broke. So I was fielding questions on anything in the soccer space and kept getting asked about what my thoughts were in terms of Columbus possibly leaving and Anthony Precourt taking the team to Austin. And I said it then, and I said it right before I went to Columbus. It made me mad. It was heartbreaking, and it was wrong, and the whole thing was a mess. And again, I mean, plenty of people are to blame, but it never should have got to that. It never should have gotten to that point. And it says a lot. And it's kind of a transformative time in sports in our country. I mean, I'm trying to think of another example, and I can't off the top of my head. I mean, this is something that happens abroad a lot, right? People step up and save their clubs, and there are a few Premier League clubs currently that had that happen. But for the fans, and that's where this starts, for Save the Crew, for the fans to step up and say, this isn't happening, the club's not going anywhere, it will forever be Columbus Crew, we will forever have a team here. I mean, what started as a sort of quiet corner and disgruntled fans very quickly became a mobilized, organized group with a message, with a lot of support. And I sent out a tweet one day just saying, you know, I'm upset. I even though I'm a former player, you know, every former player is a fan too. You know, Lee Dixon's a fan of Arsenal. You know, Graham Lasso's a fan of Chelsea. You know, it's and Musto just never stops about Middlesbrough. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on, Borough. Yeah. Come on, Borough. So, you know, we always kind of save a spot in our heart for a club we used to play for. And that spot is there for the Columbus Crew, and it was hurting. And so I tweeted something out saying, listen, any other former players upset and want to go to Columbus and stand with these guys? And I was blown away by the response, whether it was on Twitter, players that I played with and didn't have their number or never played with, or players that were texting me or emailing me. I mean, just 30, 40 messages right away from guys saying, let's do it, let's get back. Yeah. And, you know, from that moment, we just started organizing. And I give Dante Washington a lot of credit. It started with Tom Prestis, who was our goalkeeper when I was there. Dante Washington, who obviously was, you know, scoring goals for us. I those guys still live there. And so I got on the phone with them and I said, how do we do this? Here's what I'm thinking. What do you guys think? And we just had a great brainstorming session. And then Dante Washington took it and ran with it. He was, you know, going to check out fields and locations and trying to organize all these conference calls. And we were jumping on the these calls every week with local, the sports commission, who was central in keeping the team there and finding sponsorship and new ownership. And it was a really powerful, galvanizing experience to see what happens when a local group get behind something. I felt it during the election a lot. I saw fans, I saw administrators, I saw coaches, I saw some former players getting behind a movement. And it's intoxicating. It's a really special thing to see what happens when you become this force, this group that has a unified voice. And, you know, we finally got it planned and we're on our way. And, you know, a few weeks before we leave to go, we get the news that there's an ownership group that have stepped up. And you know, the ink isn't dry yet, but it looks like it's very close to happening, where a combination of another sports family, they own the Cleveland Browns, I believe, has some family, and then some local groups, our former doctor, Dr. Edwards, that did, you know, surgeries and took care of the guys, he's a part of this new ownership group. So it was a great thing, because it was going to be pretty somber. I mean, we were going back, and I took my family with me, and in my mind, I was thinking, first off, I was looking forward to the opportunity to carry my kids out onto that field, mm-hmm. you know, Crew Stadium, which now Manfrey Stadium. But I was looking forward to that moment, but it was going to be bittersweet knowing that maybe it was the last Crew game ever. And to get the news that we weren't going back to mourn the loss of a club and respect and show our gratitude to the fans for a wonderful heritage and support over the years, it was a phoenix from the flames. It was a celebration about the new era and what's to come. So it was an incredible, incredible event. We played a Legends game. A bunch of guys came back. McBride, Edson Buttle, you know, Mike Clark, and DeBrito and Winger. I mean, it was.
And you're one of the captains, right?
I let Dante pick the teams. Yeah. He loaded my team, right, which was awesome, because he knows I'm insecure and I need to win. But, you know, John Harkes and Brian Dunseth and Duncan Outen and Frankie Adick, there were others that wanted to be there that for different reasons couldn't. But it was just a really, I mean, it was amazing. It was freezing cold. It was raining, and the fans, I mean, I don't even know the total number, but definitely in the thousands came to go sit there and support and celebrate and watch the game, and we just had so much fun. It was probably one of the most fun games I've ever played in. So it was a special thing, and it was great to be able to share that with my family and connect all of that, but also reconnect with my Columbus Crew family. So it's a special thing when fans get behind a club, and that should always be protected. That should always be honored. And for the new Columbus Crew ownership, my only advice is make sure those fans have a seat at the table and they're always heard from here forward. The coffee's okay. Temperature
it's
now.
It's not burning the roof of your mouth anymore.
No, I got it. I don't know what it is, but I need coffee to be just above room temperature before I can drink it. There's some sort of affliction that Dr. Edwards didn't obviously help me with. He helped me more with my hips.
Maybe next time you go to Columbus, he can help you.
Yeah, I got that checked out. All right, let's get into games. I mean, we typically don't do this, so this is new for the Tad Pod. We're basically just ripping off the Two Robbies football show, and we're gonna go first to the Tottenham Manchester City game. 1-0 City, a Mahrez goal. Let's talk about everything. Let's dissect each team's performance and then kind of talk about the bigger picture. But before we get there, before we talk about a ball being kicked, how about that field? I have to say it's the worst I've ever seen. I can remember. I mean, it goes back to like the Wimbledon.
Match.
Yeah, it goes back to the Wimbledon. You know, knock it up to Fashanu days.
Yeah.
I mean, holy cow, was that field a quagmire? Just and also, which made it worse, it was Bobley, which, by the way, Dicko and Graham all over Lamella for missing that chance. I mean, that ball, it took a couple hops. It was hard. It wasn't that it was like soggy and all torn up. It was that it was rock hard. So the ball just didn't settle much. It was bouncing all over the place. I mean, it goes to show you how talented those two teams are, that it still was especially for Manchester City and some of their fluid movement.
Yeah, they basically still played the same way.
Yeah. I mean, incredible.
They always do, yeah.
But, I mean, it's not the NFL's fault. I mean, this is – and it's just every day we go on, every weekend we go on, the fact they're still at Wembley looks bad. But when it's that field and they can't complain about it because they signed these contracts thinking they'd be in their new stadium already, it's just – it's just bad for Spurs. I just don't know how long they can shine it on. I don't know how long they can get over the fact that they're not playing great, but they're still having a good season. I mean, the what we're waiting for is that they haven't really clicked yet. They haven't hit that top gear, but they're accruing points, right? I mean, you know, still what, 21 points or 1 point out of fourth place, just a point behind Spurs.
They're only five behind City even for the title.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's outside of Manchester United, who is gaining ground, I mean, it's kind of a logjam up there. And Spurs, their big bounce is supposed to come from this new stadium. And I just, the longer it takes and the longer we push it on, the longer it's delayed, I just, that top four becomes a more difficult ask of them.
Yeah, it reminded me of watching the early MLS days. When you see a lot of playing on baseball fields or football fields, you see all that.
Naperville.
Because I grew up in Chicago. I used to go down to
Brutal.
When they were renovating Soldier Field.
My Vapors. That was when there. Nike came out with the new Vapors, and they were paper thin, and the plastic. It was a summer game
in Naperville.
Yeah. And the plastic started melting on the bottom of my Vapors. I was just like, "What
just
are we doing?"
Because of the turf.
Oh, it was awful. Awful turf. So hot. Miserable. But it can happen to anyone.
I think it was Stu Holden. There are probably a bunch of other people that did similar tweets who said, "I'm glad to see that the Premier League's finally taking a page out of the MLS's book with the stadium." Something like that.
Though I can't remember who said it, but it was perfect. They said there was a tweet where he said, "This would never happen if there was promotion relegation," which is perfect. Listen, I believe in promotion and relegation. I want it here, but it was the perfect tweet to like show how stupid some of the arguments are for promotion and relegation. Mm-hmm. There are great arguments, and then there are really stupid ones. And that is something that like it's some pro-rel, like rabid, foaming mouth person would say. But it's just hilarious to see not only a Premier League game, but a marquee Premier League game played with an enormous NFL logo right in the middle of the field and a terrible, terrible field. Yeah. So City, it's, top of the table, level on points with Liverpool, better goal differential by 8. But no one's talking about Manchester City. I mean, it's quite remarkable. Liverpool, and listen, to be level at this point in the season with Manchester City, it goes to show how great Liverpool are. And I would say all in all, they've been more thrilling. They've had more dominant performances. It's been a bit more dramatic. I think it's been a bit more consistent. I think Liverpool haven't hit their height game in and game out. Mo Salah hasn't really started the season yet in terms of how he finished last season. But Manchester City keep trucking along. And here are a few pieces that are showing us that Manchester City are still very, very much the team to beat. Raheem Sterling, in contract disputes and all of this, I mean, he's starting to take over games. I mean, there's this, even in he had a couple bad moments. I mean, he's just he's dominant in this way where he looks different. Like, you know what I mean? His like facial expressions and his body language, he just knows that he can take over games now. And mistakes don't affect him as much. You know, he doesn't get kind of caught up in that stuff. So he is a bona fide star for that team. Bernardo Silva, I said it before the season. I watched him in preseason. He looked hungry. And David Silva is getting up there in age. He's had a couple ankle injuries. I mean, he's still absolutely brilliant. But Bernardo Silva is their new weapon of this season because he played a lot last year but didn't start a lot. Came on a lot, managed games out. I mean, he's just, especially with Kevin De Bruyne out, who came on and made a cameo and looked a bit rusty at the end, Bernardo Silva, he makes them better. Even though he was there last year, it is a different team when he's out there. And then the other one is Riyad Mahrez. So Riyad Mahrez has started the season with Manchester City. Couple of games where he's played kind of higher, or he's played in the middle. It seemed Pep was trying to work out where he was going to be at his best. I don't think he was entirely fit and kind of ready to go or understood the system that Pep wanted to play, which is very specific. But he's getting there now. I mean, that's a couple games now where he's been a goal threat. You know, he's been dynamic without slowing the game down, which I thought was always going to be the issue, because when it's Sané and Raheem Sterling, they don't linger on the ball much. I mean, they like to take people on, but they do it at pace, so it's easier for runners in the box, whether it's Aguero, whether it's Gabriel Jesus, or whether it's a midfield runner. It's easier to read what they want to do, and it's harder to defend because they really don't give you time to shift and help and slide. You know, Riyad Mahrez likes, you know, a few step overs, likes to beat you a few times, and sometimes that can throw off a well-timed, very well choreographed attacking team. But it seems Riyad Mahrez is catching up with their tempo and understanding how to bring his talent to the Manchester City group. So he's been looking a lot better recently.
Yeah, and he was one of those signings when it happened over the summer. People kind of looked at it like, do they need to make this? They were already stacked offensively. And like you said, he pretty much forced his way in as a starter. And it kind of goes back to what we always talk about with City. Their one issue might be is how do they keep playing all these guys or keeping them happy?
Yeah.
Because we'll see what happens. You know, De Bruyne trying to work his way back in. Leroy Sané still not started on a regular basis.
Well, I mean, I guess the good thing is it makes it harder for Raheem Sterling to hold them ransom, right? It makes it harder for Raheem Sterling to say, you need me. Now, listen, they do.
Yeah.
But it's there's a long line of players that every other Premier League team would love. I mean, think about Manchester United right now, where and we'll touch on them in the next topic. But you know, Alexis Sanchez, right? Like, I mean, Manchester City were in for him too, which was funny. Like, wonder what happened with that whole thing. Which surprised me that Pep was in for him because he didn't really work at Barcelona. Because he lacks the discipline that it's taken him a long time to get Raheem Sterling and Leroy Sané to understand. But, yeah, I mean, they just have wingers galore. It's just – they're starting to hit a stride at just the right time.
Yeah.
For sure.
Pep's always said he thinks Sterling has the potential to be one of the best players in the world. And so you've kind of seen – I mean, the goal, the way it happened yesterday, Trippier made a mistake on the initial header, but – He caught back up to Sterling, and Sterling still had the confidence to take him on, beat him, and then he just laid it off for Mahrez for the goal. And it's not that we haven't seen him do those types of plays before, but the way, kind of how you were talking about the body language, there was a sort of confidence he had there that just seemed new. Yeah. And I think Lee or Graham, one of them, commented on it too, that they kind of said Sterling's taking this game. His play right now is at another level than we haven't seen before.
He has this, and we always say it's the final product, but what it is he reaches these incredible speeds. And sometimes he can't slow himself down. And I don't mean necessarily physically. I mean his head. He's operating where his head seems to be going as fast as his feet are, and he never really gets settled. And whether it's a goal-scoring opportunity for himself or a pass, he just seems to be able to come out of that top gear and find the play much better than he's been able to do in the past. Let's move over to the Spurs side of things before we run out of time on this topic. So, I'm concerned again about the defensive midfield area for Spurs. I just, Dembele, you can see it, and I love him. I mean, I love him. He's a Rolls Royce, man. I mean, the way he glides by people, how good he's been in the Premier League over the past, even going back to the Fulham days where, you know, he wasn't sure if he was a playmaker or he was a deeper player. he just can't do it anymore. I mean, that game, you saw, now he made a couple of nice recovering tackles, but he just can't cover the ground anymore. And they just don't play someone there regularly enough. Now, someone came in who has a really bright future, and I think it was Lee talking about how good he thought this player was, and I totally agree. Harry Winks, he could be the answer there. I mean, he totally changed the game when he came on. And the thing I love about how he plays is he's a deep playmaker, just like Dembele, that will take risks and get turned around and play vertical through the lines. I mean, how many times did he have someone on him, dropped a shoulder or just a little shimmy or step over, fake pass, and got turned and played up the field? That's what Dembele did so well. It's what Dyer doesn't do great. And listen, Dyer's a very good player. I just think, you know, in his days in Portugal, he played a lot on the back line sometimes. I mean, he's kind of been shifted around. Yeah. And I think if I have him or Harry Winks, and it's not mutually exclusive, you can play two holders or you can play a diamond, which they do sometimes. I mean, Harry Winks is, he's exciting. He was exciting in that game. And I want to, now it's getting over injury and getting fit, I want to see him more often.
Do you think Dyer's best position is in midfield? Like you mentioned, he's been a center back. We've seen him play right back.
In
he's kind
team.
Of a Phil Jones type. I remember when Phil Jones first came to Manchester United, Sir Alex was playing him everywhere.
Yeah, and by the way, Sir Alex said he was going to be the best Manchester United player ever, didn't he, or something like that?
I'm sure that's turned out.
Yeah, I mean, that's happened with, like, Chambers and Holding, and, I mean, there's a lot of guys that haven't really sat in a role and gotten the repetitions. I think because their center backs are better than him at that. I mean, if you're talking about Alderweireld or you're talking about, I mean, even Sanchez. Yeah. But, I mean, Vertonghen's the best they've got. I mean, he just can't, unless one of those guys are hurt, he's not fitting in back there. Last thing on Spurs, well, two quick things. Dele Alli just signed a new contract.
Mm-hmm. And he came back from some slight injury issues.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's good for them. There's always been this talk of new stadium, how are they going to keep these guys? They may lose him, but I'm sure there's an enormous release clause in that new contract. So that's great for Spurs. Good job from Levy. And also pushes the attention away from some not-so-great stuff for Spurs right now. Harry Kane. So, listen, he didn't have a bad game. He actually had a couple of really nice movements, some great moments. Took a ball. He played really well with his back to the goal during the game. I noticed that they played direct into him several times. He just kept withdrawing. I just didn't like how frequently he was not the highest guy, how frequently he was coming back and withdrawing. Now, I know playing with Lucas Moura as another striker early on, that was kind of by design, but they're getting away from that a little bit. And now I just feel like there's a big void where so often great movements, Harry Kane's trailing them and he's trying to catch back up. Now, is he good at withdrawing and turning and hitting diagonal balls and linking? Yeah, he's great at that, but you know, you're much better at scoring goals. So someone else can do that. I mean, Harry Winks is good at doing that. It's just, I notice it made life pretty easy on Stones because it was just, he was always in front of him. He was always passing him on to a midfielder. They're always picking him up pretty well. It's just, I want to see him a bit further up the field.
Well, I was going to ask you, is it really on him or is it obviously the players around him, but also the way that Pochettino's playing them? We saw, you know, you mentioned Lucas Moura. He was more on the left as a left winger yesterday. And then Lamela was playing as the number 10, who I thought was having a pretty good game too. Yeah. But as like you mentioned, he was a little bit deeper, and it was really the matchup between him and Fernandinho. Fernandinho was his responsibility to stay with Lamela, which allowed, you had two center backs then in Laporte and Stones that could focus on Kane. And you have now not only Dele coming back, but Christian Eriksen.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, what's the best way they should, and you could, you know, lump in Winks and in the whole midfield, I guess their front six, you know, what do you think the best way to set up is?
I think 4-2-3-1 with a very narrow playing winger. If it's Dele Alli, if he's off the left, he's playing very narrow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Lucas Moura and Lamela challenging off the right, I mean, in my opinion.
And then Eriksen
floating. I know Eriksen plays off the wing a lot for them, or if they play a diamond, he plays as one of the, you know, plays on the side of the diamond. I just want to give him freedom. And also, I think, you know, Christian Eriksen will just like he made fun of Harry Kane for taking his goal, will say, get up there. I mean, you know, like, I think he gets the respect, and he's no one's better than him in those spaces. So I just think that's the best team with Harry Winks playing next to a Dyer, playing next to even a Dembele. And I know Wanyama, I mean, it's just brutal trying to get, I mean, speaking of injury, it just doesn't really seem like he can get back. But, like, I like that because it's flexible. You know, you can ask you can ask Harry Winks to cover on the left flank when Dele Alli gets forward, or even join the attack off the left side. You know, you can ask Dele Alli to make these great vertical runs when Harry Kane withdraws. I mean, that's one of the great parts of Spurs over the last few seasons, is when Harry Kane did withdraw, it was typically either he was fine to Dele Alli over the top or diagonally, or laying a ball first time for it to be played through. You know, we haven't seen that a lot. So I think that's the best, most dynamic formation that can be shifted into a 4-4-2 with Diamond. Mm-hmm. It can be shifted into other things. You know, I don't like the way they've been starting games, where a lot of guys aren't really in their best spots, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah,
so we'll see what he figures out. I mean, listen, if this is bad for Spurs, you know what I mean? To be sitting 5 points off of Manchester City at this point, they'll take it.
Yeah.
They'll take it all day long. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I really don't buy a lot of the people talking about Spurs issues and this and that. And like, is this a dip? Or I'm just like, well, are you looking at the points? And I mean, no, it's not that bad. So is it that bad? Or is it not, because they're starting to pick up points? Manchester United 2, Everton 1. So, a few things. It wasn't a penalty. I agree with the guys. He was dispossessed. And listen, just because you get the ball doesn't mean it's not a penalty. It was Ghana, right? Or no, it was... who was it? Check real quick. Was it Ndidi or Ghana? I can't... I want to say it was Ghana. Or not Ndidi. What am I talking about? It wasn't Leicester. Everton. I think it was Ghana.
I'll double check.
Yeah, check that. Anyway, he throws a foot in, and toe pokes the ball, and it hits into Martial's shin, and at that point the ball was getting away from him. I mean, he was losing possession. You know, the tackle was timed, the ball was first, then there was a bit of contact, and there was just a pause, and there was a second phase where Martial does make a decision to hit the ground. And so, listen, if you touch a ball past someone and they try to tackle it and get a toe poke to it and just get a little nick on it and still follow through and hit you, and you're going to possess the ball and get in behind, that's a foul. And if it's in the box, it's a penalty. I just think this one, the tackle dispossessed him enough. He was out of control. The ball bobbled off of him. You know, he made a decision, hit the ground, so I agree.
Yeah, and it was Ghana.
So, and unless Ndidi was moved illegally before January, it was not Ndidi. It was Ghana. You know, and then Pogba's penalty is just amazing. Did you see the tweet that someone put out?
Bolt?
Oh my God, amazing! He ran, what was it, the 100 or the 50?
He ran the 100 faster than he did take his penalty.
That's so good.
I saw another graphic. I'll try and see if I find it. I think it was Sky made it. They actually counted the number of steps he's taken on each penalty this season, and I think that one was like over 20 or something.
Oh my God,
so let me see
amazing.
If I can find that too.
At least Pogba has a sense of humor about it. Did you see his Instagram post where he did the walk up to his car to go to practice today? It was so good. Thank God for social media. But Pickford, what a save. And I think it was Lee who said it. It was almost too good a save. Like, he read it so well and got such a firm hand on it that it popped right back to Pogba. Instead of kind of like, you know, hitting a softer hand that buckles and it falls to him or parries to the side, what a save by Pickford. And then Pogba buries it. Yeah. All in all, you look like you want to say something.
No, I have the numbers if you
of
want
what,
it.
Steps?
Of his steps on every penalty this season.
Okay, go.
So the first one was Leicester.
At home. That was the first game of the season.
Yep, yeah. He had 17. He scored.
Amazing.
Next one was Brighton. Only 8. A little short 8-step jaunt for that one. And he converted
that's like
that
a
penalty.
Sprint.
Yeah. For him, that's a sprint. Yeah. He converted that one. Burnley, 18, missed that one. It was saved. Young Boys, 23, also he scored that one. And then this past one, 26.
Wow.
Which was saved, but then he scored.
That's remarkable. So, it's like a game of 21.
Yeah.
So, Manchester United, all in all, great performance. I mean, here's the thing is... Leicester had opportunities, but that's what happens. I mean, remember Manchester City in their first season under Pep Guardiola and even Liverpool, first few seasons under Jurgen Klopp? If you're going to take risks, you're going to get burned. I mean, it's just going to happen. So they got caught a few times. But just on the front foot and risk-taking and confident and Everton were back on their heels and just pushing, and it was relentless. There was this attacking attrition about it. Pogba was more advanced. Huge decision to sit Lukaku, which may in the long run hurt this situation, because what's wild about this is Lukaku, of everyone, is the guy that is a Mourinho guy in terms of, like, he's been on board. He came back early from his World Cup summer break. He's said all the right things in the press. You know, he obviously is in a bit of a goal-scoring rut, but Pogba's been throwing everyone else under the bus around him. You know, I mean, Martial, I mean, he's been all over him from the start. And, recently said in a bad performance from Rashford and Martial, see, that's why I don't play these guys. Mm-hmm. You know, you ask for them, but that's why I don't play them. Yeah. So what's remarkable is in this comeback, in terms of, like, the last three games, where there's some terrible performances in some of them, in the first half especially, when you look at Newcastle, the guys that are coming back for him, the guys that are performing, are all the guys that you would think just can't stand him and don't want to be there. I mean, Rashford finally getting a run through the center. Martial, Luke Shaw, Mata.
Fred came back
in. Fred, you know, I mean, Smalling, it's quite remarkable. So the performances that were the most impressive in the game for me, and listen, it's hard to not be critical of Jose because everyone's been screaming out for it. Martial, he just looked like every time he picked up the ball, he was going to run by someone, right? And a beautiful finish on that first time curling shot, similar to his goal against Chelsea where he took a poor touch first and curled it in. But I just don't get it. Like, this is the Martial we knew. Mm-hmm. This is the Martial we saw. And when they went and bought Alexis Sanchez, I remember the transfer deadline show when we sat there in the studio and I was in there with the two Robbies and we all said, why did they do this? I mean, in Martial, you have a guy that's we were saying, better than Alexis in what you want to do. And also you have Rashford who gets reps over there. So now these guys are getting bumped down the line for Alexis, who's been a miserable. It might go down as one of the worst signings in Premier League history if it continues the way it's continuing. So it's kind of shocking that, all right, here's Martial, and we knew he could do this. And here he is, and he's performing, and he's dominant. And Pogba, more advanced, took over the game several times. I mean, he's so much better when he has that freedom to get forward. Even the stuff that didn't come off, there was a slalom between three or four players in the box where he pirouetted and dragged it from foot to foot and almost got on the end of it. You know, the quality of his passing in the final third, the goal scoring, and I know he shanked a couple in this game, but the goal scoring ability that he has, he just looked happy, and Manchester mm-hmm. United looked happy. Here's the problem is, I don't think Jose Mourinho is happy with having to play that way. I would imagine it gives him panic attacks
yeah.
because it's everything that he doesn't want his teams to be. You know, risky, 1v1 in the back, pushing forward, mm-hmm. pressing for the second goal. You know, all those things that the Manchester United fans were responding to at Old Trafford that I'm responding to now and that we all sat there and said, this looks great. This is what we need from this group. It's a talented side. They're not designed to be that. So if they do stay that, it would mean Jose Mourinho changes. And it's just, at this point in his career, is he really going to do that? I think it will be a game or two from now where they revert back to being a defensive shell, sitting back, closing a big low block, no passing lanes, try to work the counter. Lukaku will probably start that game and he'll bring him back in. He might even score on the counter with his one touch in the final third. I mean, that's what they're going to go back to. Because here's the thing is, defensive stability is everything for Jose Mourinho. Manchester United is one of the poorest teams in the Premier League right now, and that's with the greatest goalkeeper on the planet.
Yeah. Well, he received so much criticism in the midweek after how they played against Juventus.
Mourinho
did.
Yeah.
Especially at home, playing defensive minded against Juventus.
Yeah, it was shocking.
So I wonder if the way that he set him up
at
home against Everton was basically saying, all right, I'll show you, we can play attack minded if this is what everybody really wants to see. And he did. And he also did say, you know, like you mentioned, I can't take Lukaku out. I couldn't play Rashford at center forward. Well, he did, and it worked. So
I mean, it's just all we need to do is it's kind of like the Daily Show, you know, when they go and get like
all the old
clips where people just contradict themselves left and right. And listen, that was a good performance, mm-hmm. and you would say in different circumstances something to build off of. It's just I would be shocked if they become that team moving forward. And here's the thing is I just don't think they're defensively strong enough to be that team moving forward.
Yeah. Well, and they
I mean Everton are especially with Richarlison up top. Mm-hmm. That was the thing with Everton where they were really poor once they were able to break out of the back and create something. Bernard missed a really good chance. I mean, Richarlison is a shadow of himself as a central striker. So, you know, a team that actually has a threat up top, you wonder if they would have been punished more because it was a tight game at the end.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting. Their next match is Saturday at Bournemouth, who, again, is usually a more attacking-minded team, even for a mid-table team towards the bottom. Then they're away to Juventus, and then the Manchester Derby is the final match before the next break. So all three matches where you could see they're all on the road, and they're all against teams that like to play. I mean, the Bournemouth will be the most interesting because that still is a team Manchester United should be on.
If they lose that game and lose to Juve, that's got to be it.
You think so? I don't think it makes it to the derby.
I just can't see what they like. You know what they see? It's confirmation bias. If since the reports came out that you know Jose Mourinho is days away from losing his job and they have a new manager lined up, it's confirmation bias to say what you've seen recently shows you that everything's okay. Right? You can go either way. Mm-hmm. It's just there's more evidence that what you've seen recently is a sign of good performances being propped up by a corroded and rotting foundation. And so it's just you can – and this is what Robbie Musto said. He said he can limp along. And he's kind of right. Like it wouldn't be crazy if Jose Mourinho finds a way to limp along because there's enough talent in that group. And by the way, let's say he put Rashford out there. And Rashford had a terrible game, and they don't get that penalty and don't get 3 points. I mean, it's a totally different conversation. Mm-hmm. You can't let the narrative swing so drastically on one call, you know, one half, you know, one player. There's just there isn't enough substantive positive data to support that this is going to be a different Jose Mourinho than the one history tells us we always see in this moment.
Yeah, that's true.
But it would be hard. They missed their opportunity. It would be hard to fire him at this point.
Well, I was actually going to ask, have they missed their opportunity, though? Because, you know...
Well, you never miss your opportunity, but they missed the easy opportunity.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, that's true, I guess. But we don't know what's going to happen, but Real Madrid just sacked their manager, and a lot of the reports were that Antonio Conte was going to come in.
Yeah.
And now those have started to die down. And again, I don't know if he would fit at Manchester United, but I wonder if all of a sudden we know Real Madrid name a full-time manager. Right now they have an interim in Santiago Solari. If that kind of plays at any part
well,
in their decision.
Here's where it would play for me. Not that Jose Mourinho is possibly the next Real Madrid manager. I don't think that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. More so that I would imagine Real Madrid have a few managers on their short list that Manchester United should have on their short list. So here's another moment, just like when Liverpool got Jurgen Klopp, you know, just like when Manchester City got Pep Guardiola, which, you know, was probably never going to happen because they had the inside track. So Manchester United were going to be late to that anyway. But, you know, just like, you know, Spurs getting Pochettino, just like all of these things, all of these managers that have done great jobs. I mean, you can even say, you know, some of the Espirito Santo and I mean, even Eddie Howe, you know, it's like, you can even go all the way there to managers that don't have big trophies and aren't successful.
Yeah, Marco Silva at Everton maybe. Yeah.
But, I mean, Emery. You know, and the job he's doing at Arsenal, and sorry, I mean, it's just how many chances do you get if you're Manchester United to miss out on the caliber manager you're looking for, while clubs in your bracket pick up these managers. Yeah. So, we'll see if they miss another one. I mean, if Real Madrid hire Zinedine Zidane, I'm leaving. That's it. That would be amazing.
If Manchester United hires them.
No. I'm saying like that's how ridiculous. The most ridiculous thing that could possibly happen, where supposedly Zinedine Zidane is linked with Manchester United and he goes back to Real Madrid. Yeah. I mean, that would end it. That would be the mic drop. But I felt very confident a month ago that Jose Mourinho's days were numbered, and I just think without a director of football. Ed Woodward wants to believe, because this is on him, hiring him to begin with, worse, giving him a contract extension. This is all on Ed Woodward. He wants to believe that he can get through this season and do it in the privacy of the summer, of the offseason, and you know, mutual agreement, one of those, you know, that old chestnut. If there was a director of football there, that person would be marching down the hallway and knocking on Ed Woodward's door, picking up the phone, talking to the Glazers. That person would be saying, all is not well. And we don't have a lot of time. We don't have a lot of chances to get the caliber of manager that we want. There's a few available. Let's do it. That's what a director of football would even have the edit team, would have the analysis group clipping videos to say, this is Manchester. This is one of the greatest clubs in world football history. This is the most successful English club of all time. This I'm showing you a video of that. I mean, that's what a director of football would be doing. And he would have a list of players that would solve problems, that would be a combination of youth value purchases, contract renewals, and a couple of big money signings, unloading about four players. I mean, a director of football would have that in front of Ed Woodward. Can't put that together. No one's putting that in front of the ownership right now. So Jose Mourinho will call the shots for the most part based on his duplicity at times, his success, his stature. Yeah. He's going to be able to bully people around Manchester United, and he's been doing it. And without a confident, secure, empowered director of football to push back on that, I could see what Robbie Musto was saying, that this could limp on. This could limp on, which means episode 30. We could be season 3, season 4, episode. We could be doing our century pod with Jose Mourinho still at Manchester United.
And we'll still have more reviews about it too, I bet.
I mean, I will either lose a lot of Manchester United Tad Potters by then
or gain
a ton just so that they can curse at their phone. But you know I love you. I love all of you. And the Manchester United fans that think I'm anti-Mourinho, I love you the most. So until next week, when I have another rant about Mourinho, stay on your feet.